Hello to everybody. April 20th, 1999, will be a day that some people will never forget in and around Columbine High School. That, of course, was when the sensational mass murder took place by two troubled older teenagers, Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris. They had been friends for several years. They were considered loners. And they had become fascinated with the subject of death and fascinated with gothic clothing, black on black. It was a very bizarre duo that they were. And a number of the other teenagers in the school were afraid of them. And yet, if you go back a couple years prior, those two teenagers were severely and constantly ridiculed by the other students. And so they had an anger that built up, and they systematically plotted to destroy as many people as they could in that school. And so it was that they tried to get handguns, and they were too young, they were minors. They couldn't get the ammunition for the firearm, so there were two other people in the school that were able to help that to happen. And the law enforcement had to deal with them later. But it was shocking to the entire country what a horrific situation could be like. And since that time, there has been a rapid increase in youth shootings at various schools. Some considered copycat activity to try to emulate. As one person that went on a dangerous spree said, Eric Harris, he's my idol. In fact, I'm wearing what he wore. In fact, the firearms that he had, those are the same ones I've got. And so there have been people that have glorified this. But at the time, it was, how could a country lose its way? How could something like this happen? And that was a question that came up in the news media all the time. This is incredible. This is unbelievable. It happened. Why? We want answers. How could this happen? Where were the parents? Don't they understand? And so the questions crescendoed. But there have been so many other incidents since then. And so it is that we've seen some even more horrific situations at Virginia Tech, where I think 33 people were gunned down and killed. The person that did it had no feeling at all. Went, did part of the deed, and then went back off campus to reload, and then come back and continue that spree. A couple weeks ago, there was a tragedy in Buffalo, New York. Last week, it was Uvalde, Texas. And law enforcement officers fear a spate of copycat murders from here on. People are more and more asking why. The Connecticut senator had to be very concerned because, of course, Sandy Hook was right in his backyard where there were 30-some-odd people that were killed, and many of them ages 6 and 7 years of age. They didn't bargain for that, robbed of their childhood, robbed of the future. How do you reconcile it? How does God reconcile something like this? How can people have hope when they see these things? And indeed, some people could ask, could there be a loving God when all of these things are allowed to happen? Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut on the floor of the Senate, was saying the same thing and raising the same questions. And one thing that he said that was very telling, and how come it's always in this country? Well, not always, but most of the time. So we are seeing whether Sandy Hook, Columbine, Buffalo, Virginia Tech, and a number of other situations, we're seeing absolute chaos. It is not unusual when you go past an elementary school in the afternoon to see parents lined up picking up their children and wondering when they drop them off, is this the last time I'll see them? And God understands, and it's important to understand God's point of view and where and how he's going to intervene to rectify this. So I'd like to address that, to talk about why we have these problems, and then what will God do about it? people don't know. They don't understand the plan of God, but certainly above all else, by the grace of God, we should. We should understand God is allowing these things to happen. I'd like for us to turn over to Isaiah chapter 3. Isaiah chapter 3. And the prophet Isaiah was inspired to write prophecy that would reach into our time. And the conditions that he describes fit this country to a T. In Isaiah chapter 3. In verse 12, it says, children are their oppressors, talking about the end time. Children are their oppressors. And the King James, I'm reading here, New Living Translation, it's a little different, but it says, childish leaders oppress my people. We see that more than ever before. And it also says in that same verse, and women shall rule over them. And I think the main thing that I read out of that is that the purpose of having that statement is, where are the men? If the women have to fill the void and to intervene and to put themselves in the leadership role, maybe and probably, and in this case, the description of society here is such that the men have abdicated their responsibilities, and by default, women. And in some cases, especially in the inner cities, it's the grandmother that's the last line of defense. Because we've now had several generations of children raising children, people that have been estranged. You talk about disunity, the opposite of what we heard already. We see disunity in this country. A house divided against itself, can it continue? I was interested to note that among the people who are speaking out most recently against another invasion of a school, such as Uvalde, was Steve Kerr. He was a former NBA player and an NBA coach, and I was astonished that he was as angry as he was, oblivious to the cameras and all. How can this happen? But we see a society where women, by default, have to step in because men are gone. They're out of the picture. Now, I admire such organizations as the Promise Keepers, for example, where there are people who've recognized, you know, we as males have shortchanged our families, and we want to make it right. We want to rectify. There are different programs out there, so give credit to where credit is due. It's wonderful that there are people that are wanting to change and to say, I was wrong. I need to change. I need to be in the lives of my children. This is incredibly important. People don't do well that lack their parents. I'll never forget, I was in Houston one time, and I got to talk to somebody who made comment and said, yes, and I remember when I was 12 years old, I came home from school. My parents were gone. They left. I was abandoned. I never saw them again. And he was 60 years old as he was telling me this. I mean, that's an extreme case. But there are many people that have been shortchanged in our society. As society has deviated and moved away from God's laws, there are repercussions. And a country can't go that way without incurring difficulties. In Isaiah chapter 3, let's go up to verse 1 and note the moral condition, the mindset of the brethren, of the people in the country. Chapter 3, verse 1, the Lord of heaven's armies will take away from Jerusalem and Judah and other areas where people trample his laws, everything that they depend on, even bread and every drop of water. Again, I'm reading from the NLT here. All their heroes and soldiers and judges and prophets, fortune tellers and elders, anybody in high visibility, army officers and high officials, advisors, skilled craftsmen and astrologers. Well, we understand that God is against astrology, but all of the people in high profile position in the society, it says God will remove them all. And he says in verse 4, I will make boys their leaders and toddlers their rulers. Maybe not literally, but figuratively speaking. And people will oppress each other, man against man, neighbor against neighbor. And the young people will insult their elders. That is where we are seeing ourselves at this time. Now, God will one day rectify it. The time is coming soon when Jesus Christ will be back on the earth. And we will eliminate war. People will beat their swords into plowshares. Nation will not lift itself up against nation anymore. There's going to be wonderful changes. The desert will bloom like a rose. There will be well-watered land in the Middle East. You'll have water running, fresh water, down to the Dead Sea on one side, down to the Mediterranean on the other. You read about that at the end of Ezekiel. You see that in various other places in the Bible that shows that God is going to have a hands-on policy. Once Christ returns, it's going to be the opposite of the way it is now. But he's allowing man to write the lesson of history. I've run into people that say, well, where was God in all these different things? How come God didn't intervene? Where was God in Columbine? And the answer, he was not there. And the answer is, and this is important to understand, the society, for ever since the Israelites came out of Egypt to Mount Sinai, and they were given the Ten Commandments, and they refused to keep them, the message that mankind has given God by his actions is, God, you leave your nose out of our business. You leave us alone. You let us do what we want to do because that's what we want to do, whether it coincides with your laws or not. And just we'll be independent. Thank you very much. And then when something goes wrong, oh, where was God? You can't have it both ways. You can't say to God, not that anybody here is doing that, but, you know, leave us alone, don't bother us, we're not interested in you, your ways, your laws, your plan, and then, oh, something bad happened to us. Must be God's fault. He could have changed it. Yes, he could have. And he has intervened at times for his people, but if they break his laws with impunity, he's not obligated to bail them out. Not a country, maybe individuals. But this is the kind of situation that people don't understand. And I would like now to go over to Micah chapter 4. Malachi. Same direction, we're close. Malachi chapter 4. And there's a very important prophecy that's applicable to us today. Here in chapter 4 of Malachi, in verse 4, it says, remember to obey the law of Moses, my servant. All the decrees and regulations that I give him on Mount Sinai for all of Israel. Look, I'm sending you the prophet Elijah before the great and dreadful day of the Lord's arrival. His preaching will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. Otherwise, I will come and strike the land with a curse. Now, there are some end time applications here that apply to the time in which we live, in the country in which we live. And there is an Elijah type work that's going on now that we've, as far as carrying a gospel message to the world. But additionally, we see that I need to concentrate on verse 5, where it talks about before the return of Jesus Christ, you know, his preaching will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. We live in a fatherless society for the most part. Too many fathers have abdicated their roles. And God has said that unless I can get the fathers' hearts turned back to the children, then, unfortunately, they will have to face the consequences. And the consequences are that children do not do that well without their parents. They were never intended to be farmed out, to be alone and shunted aside and belittled. And never has the value of human life been so low in this country. When you look at 60 million abortions, and why are they? It's for convenience sake. How does that square with what God wants? You see, God is a family. He's oriented that way. He wants to bring sons and daughters into his family. There are any number of scriptures throughout the Bible that emphasize that. And so, if it's not happening, it's because people are putting up roadblocks. They're saying, family sounds nice, but I've got a better idea. I've got to run with this crowd. I've got to risk breaking God's laws in order to achieve these thrills or this opportunity. And people make shortcuts with God's law, and they reap consequences. It's impossible to make the wrong way work. What God is looking for is for people and nations to repent and to change, and to rediscover their families in some cases. It's not unusual to talk with, and I tread softly here because I know I'm walking on eggshells, because a number of us have had difficulties maybe in the past, and people have gone through the agony of divorce and farmed out children that are now seven states away and under custody. If you ever saw the movie Catch Me If You Can, this was back a while, it's a true story. And the amazing thing with that is the person, Frank, it was Albigen or something close to that, he had the unfortunate experience of not knowing that his mom and dad were at odds with each other. And he was summoned to court. I think it was in New York City. So he shows up and he finds out his parents are getting a divorce. And then immediately they say, and you need to choose which parent you're going to live with. And he just freaked out. He couldn't do it. He turned and he ran. He ran out of the courtroom. He ran down the street, tried to run away from anybody and anything that he recognized. And he decided to stake it out on his own. And because he was an incredible genius, living at on the edge of disaster, he was able to fake his way as an airline pilot for Pan American, followed by faking his way to getting a law degree and working at a hospital and so forth. It's a fascinating story, and it really happened. In fact, when it was over, part of the FBI wanted to throw him in jail for forcing them to chase him for thousands and thousands of miles. And part of them said, this guy's a genius. If he's willing to help us, we'll not only prevent him from serving jail time, he can be in charge of our departments and help us. But that was engendered by the fact that he was asked to make a choice that no child should ever have to make. And it was difficult, but it was what happened. And so we see this is a pivotal prophecy about the future. God says that he wants the fathers and the sons and daughters and all to blend together to be a family again. Is in fact, God is a family. And then when he adds us, it will bring great joy to him because it'll mean expanding his activities. We have a whole solar system and universe out there in which perhaps God will expand the human race to go to other places. Doesn't say that in the Bible exactly, but there are implications. Eye has not seen nor ear heard what God has in store for him. That's in 1 Corinthians 2. So important to understand that God has a recipe for success. He knows what works and what doesn't. He knows what he has to do, but people have to come to surrender. They have to finally say, or the human race as it exists today, God, we have messed up. We have failed. We have not been able to achieve the standard of happiness that we thought that we could by living apart from your laws. When people are brought to their knees and to pray and to ask for God's help, then they will see where God is. Then God will be very hands-on. But he has allowed man 6,000 years to do it his way. And that's an important thing for us to understand, is that our perspective is different than just what happens today or what happens tomorrow. There are going to be more of these mass murders. It's inevitable. One reason it's inevitable, it has been estimated, I'll quote a statistic if I have time later, and the people that came up with it in their research. But do you know how many people have suicidal tendencies? And a lot of these these shooting sprees in these high schools are inextricably linked with suicide. People that kill others typically don't feel good about themselves either. 15% of the United States in turmoil. And that is shocking to me, but not as shocking as when I first started to study some of this. Remember, we were doing a presentation at Florida State University, and I asked different people, what do you recommend that we have for a topic? And it came back, anxiety and depression. And I'm thinking, if you read Ecclesiastes 9 and other places, you see where people are supposed to be vibrant and happy in their youth. And in your youth, you don't have aches and pains and things that hold you back. But here in the prime of life, there are a lot of disenchanted people. It doesn't happen overnight, but it happens when people get away from God, and then their next generation is even further removed from God. And then God says over in Ezekiel 20 that he gives finally human beings over to laws that are not good, a society that is second rate, a society that is stripped of its religious and ethical moorings. And this is what we see. The number of teens with suicidal thoughts has doubled in the last 10 years. And there are statements out of the Proverbs. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives him far from him. The rod of discipline, spanking, that's not a popular concept anymore. But it says in Hebrews 12, verse 6, that God will spank those whom he loves. He wants a better future for them. And that's an inexpensive price to pay if it's done properly and without, very properly and with caution. But even if that option did not exist, there are things that we should consider doing as a family in order to strengthen our relationship with each other and with God. If everybody could do that, the moral fabric of this world would be so much stronger. So let's talk about some of the advantages of doing things God's way within a family structure. And one of the most important things, especially in an affluent society such as this, where we have so many activities, so many distractions, so many things that people can do, one of the most important things that I would suggest that we do is eat together. The family meal, the main meal of the day, is incredibly important, because that is where you get a chance to comment on the day's activities and maybe ask and say, well, what would have been a better outcome? How could so-and-so have achieved this or that? Or here's something I learned in my history class, or here's some other things that I've stumbled onto in my reading. And you share those ideas, you interface. There was a scary study that came out in August of 1974 by Yuri Bronfenbrenner. He was a psychologist. And through his studies, he was trying to measure how much interaction a father had with a son in the United States. Back then, this is a while ago. Anybody guess? 3 minutes. Couple minutes. 37 and a half seconds a day. That's enough time to say at the dinner table, can you pass the bread, pass the milk? Where are the car keys? I got to go. We got an activity. And that's it. So maybe you talk 3 minutes with your dad, and then you go a whole week without any discussion, so that it comes out to 37 and a half seconds. Now, that's not enough time for any kind of relationship with anybody. But people that eat together, if they can interface with each other, it's a real blessing. The danger is, well, that's a great idea, but we can't do it Monday night, that's Scouts. Tuesday night, Little League. Wednesday night, that's ballet. And Thursday night is something else, and then we've got weekend tournaments everywhere. And, you know, it's go, go, go. And it sounds fun. I got caught up in that. I wasn't married yet. If I were, I'd probably be a widower now. But you can't extract something out of nothing. You have to put in the time. And if people don't have quality time like that, then the time they might be investing is in divorce court, and who gets this kid, and where does this one go? It's just an inferior society that Satan tries to paint with glitter and gold and say, this is good, this is interesting. Now, there's nothing wrong with extracurricular activities, but in balance. But a lot of people go overboard. And so they have time, or they take their kids to soccer practice. They take their kids to this and that, but they're not having much quality interaction. Well, you could talk in the car. Well, I can't, not with the traffic that I encounter. So a bit better out here in wider open spaces. But anyway, it's a challenge, but making the time is certainly important. When a family can eat together and converse together, it really promotes a camaraderie and a closeness. Another thing that was such a huge blessing in ancient times was that God is very agrarian oriented, very much into gardening, if you will. He had the Garden of Eden. He's inspired mankind to have that same interest, want to renovate, to take what is ugly and turn it into what is beautiful. It's the mind of God. And he is for agriculture. One of the prophecies when Christ returns is that every man will be under his own fig tree. In other words, there's going to be private ownership. And in fact, according to the laws of the Old Testament, that you can't give your land away. You could sell it or maybe pass it on to somebody, but every 50 years, the Jubilee year occurs and it reverts back to the original owners. That means that if one family is irresponsible in how they spend money and they borrow money against their property, whether they repay it or not, instantly goes back, reverts back to being free and clear property that the next generation will inherit. So nobody, the next generation is not behind the eight ball. It's interesting that Herbert Hoover, former president, said one time, talking about inflation, the possibility of runaway inflation and other economic issues, he said, blessed are the youth, for they shall inherit the national debt. And that's where it's going. God is so desirous of us passing on our values to our children and to their children's children. He says that it's one thing to lay up treasure for your children's children. How about godly character? And that comes from instruction and communication. So let me say one more thing about an agrarian society, which the future will be. There will be cities in the future when in the kingdom of God. Jerusalem being the largest or one of the principal cities in the capital of the world. But aside from that, there'll be other cities, but there'll be a lot of wide open space in land that is claimed that has never maybe been utilized. But anyway, there'll be renovation projects. It'll be an exciting time. You read about that in Isaiah 40, and again, the latter chapters of the book of Ezekiel. And when I talk about being under your own fig tree, it implies an agrarian society that people will grow a lot of their food. There may be supermarkets, I don't know. That's fine. But there will be a lot of individual responsibility. And this is a fantastic opportunity to spend time with children. And to teach them how to garden, teach them how to raise cattle, and so forth. And there's no, you know, in our world, too often for many families, there's been childhood and then the teenage years are fun and games. There's nothing wrong with either, but if it's in balance. But it's like some people never grow up. And if they lived in an agrarian situation, not that every job is tied into the agriculture, but if for those that are, there are so many valuable lessons you learn. And there are so many different analogies in the Bible that refer back to agrarian activity. So it's a great opportunity to take small children, give them chores, give them jobs. And as they get older, they manage more and more responsibility. They grow up more quickly and they become full-fledged adults more quickly. And we don't have a Star Wars generation of people that are just glued to their TV sets for an average of 8 hours a day, believe it or not. I don't know how they have time for that. We don't even have a TV set. Haven't. You know, we can always watch what's necessary on computer, and information seems to be instantaneous these days. But people have shortchanged themselves by divorcing themselves from the standards that God has, the opportunities that God gives. And so it is that they miss that opportunity sometimes. But when you find that families are close-knit together, they do have different projects going on, and they are involved with each other. But there are some important scriptures that to consider when we talk about raising the next generation. And we need to be in their lives. And if we were, we wouldn't have the Columbines. It wouldn't happen. You see, these people that commit these crimes, these heinous activities, they don't feel good about themselves. They're angry. They write poetry, talking just before they go out and do the deeds. They're angry. They talk about maybe talking with a few friends. The Columbine duo didn't have any friends except each other. One had a falling out with somebody, and then that person made up with him. And so on the day of the shooting, I forget which one it was, Eric or Dylan, said to the newly redeemed friend, you don't need to be around here today, April 20th. Why don't you go back home? And the person did. But anyway, sometimes people feel rejected. They feel that their parents are chasing the American dream. There's nothing wrong with wanting to better oneself, get additional education, and so forth. But sometimes people move up the social ladder or move up the economic ladder so fast that they leave their children behind. Oh, I'll make it up to them later. Well, my three-year-old will always be three. I mean, that's the way it works. What? He's 10, he's 20, he's out on his own. So, you know, life doesn't wait for anybody. And it rolls on. And people can end up shortchanging the next generation by not providing encouragement and instilling a love of different things, a love of a work, of the work ethic. And if people miss that, then they're ill-equipped to deal with the activity in the world. So God is one that is one to promote responsibility. And you read about that when you read about the descriptions of families. And it says in Proverbs 31, you know, it talks about the virtuous woman. Well, it's difficult for her to be a virtuous woman and do all the different extracurricular things that she does, and even buys land and shops for clothing for her family and so forth, and is so thrifty she's able to make some of those clothes and save money to invest in some other things. How could she do that unless she was married to a Proverbs 31 husband? So sometimes some people will say, well, if somebody says, well, my wife's not a Proverbs 31 wife, well, maybe they're the ones that are holding her back. Ooh. So you never know. But there doesn't have to be any casualties or losers or embarrassed people. When we look at a subject like this, it's where do we go from here? Being proactive. What can I do to make tomorrow better? And as idealistic as we are, as a people, I think that we readily think, yes, that's what I want to do. That's where I want to be. I'd like to now talk about what it's like to be in the throes of depression and understand that there are consequences for everything that we see that happens all around us. And I've talked already about how the solution to all of these different ills, social ills, is for people to reconnect with God. And then by doing that, they can reconnect with each other. And there is a prophecy that's mentioned in the book of Amos. I think I'll just turn to it. Amos chapter 3 in verse 3. You can turn there if you wish. Amos 3, verse 3, that says, "Can two people walk together except they be agreed?" And we have to be on the same wavelength with God in order to be blessing to what he wants and for him to bless us and to turn the hearts of the fathers to the sons and vice versa. That didn't happen with any of these people that have gone on these killing sprees. So being in unity, again tying into the sermonette, very critical. And it's, you know, we can do that at the dinner table when we're conversing with each other. There's a statement, and God is so oriented toward the older generation teaching the younger generation. He even talks in Titus about how it's important for the older women to be able to share their skills. Somebody like Pat Greenfield, for example, who's got a master degree in gardening, and their husband being, of course, they're members here. They're in Tallahassee this Sabbath. But there's a great example of people with tremendous knowledge being able to impart it. And Pat said yesterday to me on the phone, yeah, we had a group here last week. And then, of course, a number of us were there a month ago. And so learning how to scan and store a food that saves money and saves space in the house. Anyway. Could get off on that with a lot of detail, but I've got to move on. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 7, another scripture that's so important, and this is when God was leading an idealistic group of Israelites out of Egypt. The mindset that God had was in chapter 6 and verse 7, talking to his people. He says, "Repeat to them again and to your children," talking about the law, the commandments, and the blessings that come about it. Not that we're saved by the law, we're saved by grace, but keeping God's law is very important. It keeps us on track. Talk about the laws of God. It says, when you are at home, and when you are on the road, and when you are going to bed, and when you are getting up, tie them to your hands and wear them on your forehead. Figuratively speaking, is reminders. Write them on your doorposts of your house or on your gates. You could if you wish, but the main thing is in our hearts that we are covenanted with God to want to live his life, invite his ways into our heart, our being, our life. So this is a constant challenge. I don't think that God expects us to do it 24 hours a day without fail. But certainly at strategic times throughout the day and around the dinner table, at other times, sharing life will involve getting around these type of thoughts in order to be constructive. And having said that, now I'd like to take us back to Columbine and to consider, not just look at it from our point of view, but what was it like for the parents of the deceased? And you might think, oh, we're going to talk about the anger of the parents that lost children. No. Well, we might touch on that. But there was one woman by the name of Sue Diebold, which I was just blown away by. She's written at least one book. She goes on speaking tours. She is the mother of her son, Dylan Klebold, who was part of the Columbine Massacre. She said, "I know that I will live with these multiple tragedies of what happened there the rest of my life. What I lost cannot compare to what the other parents lost. And she went on to say, and our medical system is not equipped to help everyone. There are sometimes telltale signs that something's going wrong in a troubled mind, and nobody knows exactly how to penetrate that and find out what's going on in time. I mean, too often, people that have gone out to commit heinous crimes left clues, maybe even up to 2 years ahead of time, with a despondency in their letter writing, or a megalomania, thinking, I hate the world, but Adolf Hitler is good. When the Columbine massacre occurred, it was on Hitler's birthday. That was probably not an accident. But Sue Klebold went through extensive counseling, trying to cope, and feeling humiliated, doing penance forever, so it seemed. 2 years after the Columbine massacre, she came down with breast cancer. 2 years after that, she had serious mental health problems. And her thoughts were, quote, I would be terrified to meet the parents of the deceased, or see myself on the news, or fear to be suddenly accosted by an angry person and criticized for being a terrible parent. And she would think, my son, he was precocious, he was bright, he was happy, he was fun to be around. But somehow something happened later on toward the last couple of years of his life. And I won't go through the series of despondencies and misdemeanors that he and Eric had committed, but predictably everything got worse as time went on. And I wondered, did that happen with Cain and Abel and with other people that are mentioned in the Bible? And often it says in the Proverbs that the heaviness is on the mother. And you wonder, well, where was Dad? Again, six states away, far away. There was a song that came out in 1977. It was, I think, Bob Dylan did it. I wanted to play it, but I don't know the copyright law, so I ended up choosing not to. And I really can't sing it, but it talks about the danger of somebody having a heart attack, tack, 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 tack. You ought to know by now. And it talks about, it sounds like mom and dad are trying to get up the economic ladder. They're scrambling, they're hustling. And this person is kind of a victim to that because he doesn't like it. And it looks like in the lyrics that his mom is interested in moving up. And he says, if you're moving up, I'm moving out. You know, that's it. Line in the sand. I'm done. I'm done with this family. Pardon?
Billy Joel.
Okay. All right. In safety, there. In multitude of counsel, there's safety.
Same neighborhood.
Yes. We pay our people a lot of money to keep me on the straight and narrow, right? So, anyway, this person, the lyrics are angry lyrics. And the person is screaming out, whether it's about dad getting a second job as a bartender or mom trying to cope with yoga and so forth, there's just not enough of time, enough money, enough everything, or so it seems. And so the person that's written the lyrics and all singing about himself, the basic message is, you're not spending time with me. And a lot of times, life is not much more complicated than that. And so we see the repercussions. We see the curse in Malachi. And, you know, God is allowing that. That curse is on the television every week or two with some outlandish shootout. It's disgusting. And God doesn't like it, but he can't. If he intervenes now, then he bails humans out. And they'll say, well, it wasn't so bad, was it? We'll go back and do it just like we always did it. I need to conserve time here, but there is the example of the prodigal son in Luke 15. And it's interesting. Well, I will turn to part of it. You can turn there if you wish. But in Luke chapter 15, the father had two sons. One was profligate. He wasted his inheritance. The other, we don't hear as much about him, but he was super self-righteous. He was so bitter There was no love in his heart. And it's interesting that he said, he wouldn't claim him as my brother, but he referred to, when talking to Dad, he says, your son came back, and we're throwing a party for him. It doesn't make any sense. You know, nobody celebrated with me when I followed the rules, and I didn't get any kind of a celebration. And the father says, well, all that I have is yours. But no, he had some issues. They both had issues. And maybe they were wayward because the father might have not been the perfect parent. I can remember a class that I had in Ambassador College. It was Marriage and the Family, taught by Dave Antion. And he says, now that we've covered all this and we're about ready to close, you know, I've set a standard, or I've talked about God's standard. He says, don't be surprised if you go out and make hundreds and hundreds of mistakes raising a family. But, you know, humans are resilient, and many thrive. It's when it's thousands and thousands of time and over years. But there's a story. The whole story behind the prodigal son's father is not completely known. But one thing that is noteworthy is the father never cut the path or put a roadblock on the path between his prodigal son and home. And the prodigal son apparently understood it enough instinctively that he could come back home, which he did. I find it also interesting in chapter 15, excuse me, says in verse 3 or 4, if a man has 100 sheep, one gets lost, what will he do? He'll leave the 99 and go back and redeem that 1%, that one sheep. Later on, here's verse 8, a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one, and it is found. And so it is that that's a 10% value. In the first story, one sheep that was lost was found, and that's 1% of the flock. With the parable of the lost coin, you're talking about 10%. And then, in verse 11, you read about the prodigal son and his brother. The prodigal son represents 50%. You see the increase of percentage from 1 to 10 to 50. In other words, God puts a greater premium on human life than he does on animals or things. But we have to be careful. We can't micromanage our offspring, but we can't neglect them either. Sometimes people are at one extreme or the other. We live in a very permissive society, and that creates its own difficulties. And then too stringent is another thing altogether. Turn over, if we will, to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians 6. In verse 1, chapter 6, verse 1. But as the believers rapidly multiplied, there were rumblings of discontent. The Greeks speaking, oh, that's all true, but that's not Ephesians. I'm sorry. Okay, try it again. Chapter 6 of Ephesians, verse 1. Children, obey your parents because you belong to the Lord, for this is a right thing to do. I'm reading again from the NLT. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise. If you honor your parents, things will go well for you and you will have a long life on this earth. God would need to intervene to assure that that would happen. What a wonderful option. But that is not something that happens in a split second. It takes time to cultivate. I know that there have been people that I've spent time with, counseled with at times, that maybe made a mess of things, if you use vernacular, and yet turned to God. And it was like being in an airplane that was losing altitude, and they start to get at the controls and they start to make the right course adjustments. But before the plane gets way high, it ends up bottoming out. And so even though the decisions are made at this point in the flight of the plane, there has to be course correction, and it's still losing some altitude. So in other words, if, let's say, we alienated the entire human race, and now we're going to try to help everyone, it might take them a while to figure out, hey, these people really are serious. It may take time for that plane to bottom out, but then when it does, then more blessings than kickbacks occur, and then it's all blessing. And so it's the foundation is crucial. Children, obey your parents, and good things will happen. Now, it says, verse 4, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger by the way that you treat them. You know, my great-grandfather was a brain surgeon. His son was a brain surgeon. My dad was a brain surgeon, and you're going to be. So you put those Legos away. You're not going to go into engineering. You know, people can think that way. I remember counseling, working with a person. He's in prison now. When he was 15 years old, he could throw a baseball 89 miles an hour. That's in professional ball, that's acceptable. He was 15. The upside for him was, who knows? And his dad was an avid fan and made it clear to his son at any age, you name the age, you're going to play pro baseball. You're going to be with the New York Yankees, and you're going to play. He was growing up in South Florida. He was told that over and over and over again. And he enjoyed it, but his father pushed him and pushed him. And people have done that. Jennifer Capriati, a tennis player, same thing. When she was born, put in a crib, there was a tennis ball hanging over her head. And as she got a little older, she could move it around. And she was had a chance at the age of 15 and 16 to challenge for the world championship. And then she couldn't take it anymore. She had been pushed and pushed and pushed. Then she lost interest in tennis, got into shoplifting and facing potential jail time and so forth, and has disappeared from society. Interesting that a future rival, the father of the Venus, the Williams sisters, held them back, wasn't going to throw them into the limelight. He taught them, he loved them, cared about them, but he wasn't going to run roughshod over them beyond what they could handle. And if that meant taking a year off or a timeout, he would do it. That was balance. And there's a movie that's recently come out, very interesting, that covers that story. But you can't push people beyond their own interests and abilities. And it's just crucially important. And there are those examples where people have gone, you know, to one extreme or the other. Back to Sue Klebold. She said, in her situation, I felt I was attacked everywhere. She was afraid to be in public. She was humiliated by what her son had done. But some of the things that she wrote about, I think, belong in this sermon. She said, I felt I was attacked everywhere, in my office, in the hardware store, or even at night by someone that I would read about in a book that would remind me of this horrific event that happened in my family's life. My mind would spin, and being afraid would consume all of my thoughts. Every time someone would come up to me in the store and exclaimed, how could you not know? How could you not know that your son was a murderer waiting to happen? She said it felt like a punch in the gut. She said most parents do not know and would never dream. But there are many children that are so despondent, and she really decided to be courageous, and after extensive counseling, then she went on a speaking tour, which I think still continues, and is there to help other people that go through it. But one thing, if I were to ever have a chance to have a conversation with her, And maybe the most important point of this whole sermon is that, unlike other people that don't understand, we understand the plan of God. We understand that not only are people resurrected to eternal life soon when Christ returns, that there is going to be, for these people that didn't even know who God was, they will be brought back to life 1,000 years after Christ lands on the earth. We call it the second resurrection. Revelation 20, verse 5, and the rest of the dead were not alive again until the 1,000 years were finished. In other words, Christ comes back, you have 1,000 years of peace, and then the rest of humanity, people that never believed in God or never heard of God, or maybe they did, but they didn't make him a priority, whatever, they're going to be brought back to life. And everybody that died at Columbine, at Sandy Hook, and all these people will be alive. It will be unfair to say that they will not be, or that they'll be deprived of their childhood. They will have their childhood. They will be blessed. They will have interaction. They will reunite with their families. This is one of the most exciting things, and yet it's something you don't see in denominations, because Satan hates the idea of a family. He hates the idea that human beings could be reunited. They could be under God's guidance and influence. But that is the great, I was going to say equalizer, but it's the great blessing that people that are going through agony, through remorse, that's not healthy to be in a constant state of emotional turmoil. These people will have their opportunity. There will be closure to all of this. The pain will go away. The sorrow that we read about, in the death of a loved one, you know, it's like a sting and it goes away. Well, for those that when they come up in the second resurrection, which is a fascinating concept, and it would take a number of sermons to really do justice to cover what that's all about. But the fact that it has is God's guarantee. You know, the people that say, well, where was God when this happened? They're going to be silenced. They're going to be embarrassed. They're going to see a beautiful world, and they're going to see people brought to a state of happiness and relief, and the remorse will be gone, and it will be a huge, huge time. Another thing that I would say to those people that are in agony is that there is such a thing that God is repentance. There is such a concept as being forgiven of one's sins. This sounds so elementary. I'm shocked at how people maybe are afraid to forgive themselves because they think, you know, what I did was so heinous, so wrong. But it says in Psalm 103, as far as the east is from the west, so will God remove from us our sins. And so there is closure for those that want closure, that will take the time to get acquainted with God. That's the solution. So as I mentioned before, and if I didn't, you'd probably predict it anyway. When the next tragedy strikes, and there are 10 or 20 students or whatever it is, God allows it. It's not going to always be that way. And God can provide protection for those that would ask for it, that want to submit to him. And otherwise, there is a resolution to these problems. It's part of the overall need for human beings to reconcile with God on all levels and to replace selfishness with a high degree of value of life, for people to surrender their wills and to work toward making this a happier world by making each person happier. That will end the suffering and the frustration that people have had. So I think that of all people, we should be the most optimistic on earth. We know that there are solutions for the worst, ugliest, nastiest problems imaginable. And it's right out there in front of us. When we talk about the return of Christ, we're going to be talking about these turning points, winning the lives of people back to a higher standard of living.